got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I've got a broken thing.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Biotech Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm your host, Cameron English. When I wrote my first article about crop biotechnology about a decade ago, I knew almost nothing about farming, and I had to spend countless hours reading and watching lectures on YouTube and talking to experts to get up to speed so I could write about this topic with some confidence. And if I had a book that laid out the basics of agriculture and plant genetics, my life would have been so much easier. And my guest today has written the book that I wish I had back in 2010. Robert Syke is an agronomist, an entrepreneur, and a popular speaker. And his new book, Food 5.0, is designed to teach the public how farmers operate, because let's be honest, most of us just have no idea how our food is grown. So with this book, Robert wants to clear up some misconceptions about farmers and how they work and their understanding and their use of technology, and then really explain where food production is going and just how technology is revolutionizing the way we produce food. So without any further ado, here we go. All right, Robert, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm doing very well, Cameron. You caught me recording today. I'm in northern Saskatchewan farm, 14,000 acres. We got a farm tour outside, and the guys are having a look at crops. And it's just one of those really good kind of summer farm days.
Well, it's 105 here in the suburbs of Sacramento, so I am a bit jealous. Let's just say that. So I'm really excited to talk about the book, but before we do that, I was hoping you would just give people a little bit of background about yourself. I know on both sides of your family, you come from an agricultural family. And so tell me about yourself, and then tell me why you're so passionate about food and farming.
Both sides of families come from Baltic descent, Ukrainian and Polish descent, and both came to Canada to begin their settlement here as farmers. It's kind of all I've known. I grew up on a farm and graduated with a degree in agriculture and farmed for a while. Still have ownership of an operation in Uganda as well as some cattle in Saskatchewan, but really, my career expanded into agribusiness, Cameron, and I've been involved in the creation of, I don't know, something like 15 companies in the agribusiness sector. The last one was really the largest group of companies called AgriTrend and AgriData, and we had approximately 185 or so consultants in that organization working with thousands of farmers on millions of acres, and I developed that whole process to help guide farmers on the allocation of resources. We sold that organization to Trimble. My background is plant physiology, soil chemistry, crop nutrition, but I'm highly focused on technology integration on the farm. And I have been passionate about telling agriculture stories to a broader audience. And that's why I think I'm on your show today.
Yeah, very good. And this is your life, more or less, is what you're telling me. And so to get into the book, you open it with an important point, I think. And you say that in the developed world, at least, nobody's hungry. Nobody's really facing, a very, very difficult life. But you say that it could get worse, that there's potentially a lot of trouble ahead. So what point are you making when you say that?
Well, I think, again, we, by and large, most people listening to this podcast are elitist by the fact that they're born in North America. Most of us have ample access to food, shelter, abundance of clean water. We have lots of clean water. We have and most of us are fairly affluent. So we don't worry about a famine. We don't worry about pandemics or epidemics. And we don't worry about war. When you think about the time in which we live, we're really blessed people that we don't worry about those things. But historically, over man's occupation on this planet, those three things have always been very, very front and center. And, disease such as UG99, which, again, not many people understand, is a disease floating around the wheat crop right now. And it's now in Asia and can make its way in Australia. Those are devastating diseases to agricultural production. And we have all sorts of challenges facing us, particularly if we're going to ensure global food security to 2050 and beyond.
Okay, so basically we're going to have to turn to technology to really be able to feed the world. And I think the figure, it's like 10 billion by 2050. So we've got a lot of mouths to feed, and we have to come up with solutions to it. So that leads into my next question. You say that technology is a huge part of agriculture, and it has been for decades. And I want you really to correct what I think is a misunderstanding among people like me who live in the suburbs or who live in the big cities, who almost have the impression that farmers, like they aren't very smart, or they don't understand their own business, that they don't understand the importance of sustainably growing food. And I think that's a really big myth, and the connection to technology really debunks that. So I'm hoping you can elaborate on that for us.
Well, this is a great question. I sit right now in the office of a farm family house in Norquay, Saskatchewan, 14,000 acres, and on the shelf is a plaque. And the plaque says that this farm is a century farm. In other words, this farm is now 111 years old. And people talk that farmers are dumb and don't understand sustainability. You show me how many businesses out there that you know that are 100 years old or longer. This farm is being run by the fourth, soon to be the fifth generation of farmers on this land. And there are all sorts of century farms across North America. To me, those farms are extremely sustainable. The land that they grow on is owned by their family, and that land is in better shape than it was when they broke it. It's growing crops that are three or four times the yield of when they started farming this land. And so people's understanding of what is actually going on a farm today is vastly disproportional to reality. In other words, one of the things I say, Cameron, is we need to get rid of the image of the little red barn and get rid of the round fendered pickup truck and farmers in bib overalls, because that ain't farming today.
Right. Not your grandpa's farm. I think that's the phrase you use. Okay. And I think the people who perpetuate that or embrace that idea, they sort of look to food as like a new religious system, like the way their food is grown. And that's another thing you mentioned in the book. And so, I mean, I'm making that connection. I think the people who misunderstand farming tend to put their food on a pedestal almost. And so talk a little bit about that, as food is this new religion, which is a concept that you cover.
Well, whether you're paleo or vegan or vegetarian or you're organic or GMO or non-GMO or conventional or regenerative or agroecological, everybody gets around a table and they all start shouting each other that they understand the way, that this is the truth in the way. The truth in the way is not to eat any more meat. Really? What are we supposed to do with all the land that's perfectly designed to turn cellulose and hemicellulose into protein? And so what I do is I try to reframe the conversation to one of shouting about religion, to one of really having a discussion around infinite sustainability. For so long as there's going to be humans on the planet, we need to ensure that agriculture is infinitely sustainable. And so let's have a conversation around the components of that infinite sustainability, things like soil and water use efficiency and greenhouse gas balance, perhaps animal welfare, and the number one thing that everybody forgets. You can't have sustainability if you don't have farm viability. For without farm economic viability, there's no farmers left to farm sustainably if they're going broke. So park all your religions for a while and park your opinions, and let's start to really discuss agriculture from the standpoint of facts and science as it pertains to infinite sustainability, because I think that affects us all.
Yeah, absolutely. And since you mentioned animal welfare, very briefly, would you say something about so-called factory farming? I've had a veterinarian on the show before that went through that whole topic. But just to give people a brief rundown, you make a really interesting point, I think, which is that people take care of their animals because it's in their economic interest to do so. By farmers,
I work with dairy operations. I work with cattle, cow-calf operations. I work with feedlot operations. Nobody makes money by abusing their animals. Their animals, if they're abused, they don't make the farmer money. And so You know, I could take you out to a dairy operation where the manure is being cleaned right behind the cow. The cow is being fed regular rations. Music is playing in the dairy barn. And there's big back scrubbers that turn with big rotating back scratchers that they go underneath and they get, it is beautiful. And the images that activist organizations such as PETA throw out there are designed to vilify. And in any industry, you have some bad actors, but that is not the norm. And I don't focus a lot on animal agriculture in the book because my background really is broadacre farming and broadacre crop production. But from the standpoint of my own cattle, why would I abuse my cattle if they're healthy and they're happy and they're growing and they're having calves? That's how we make money off them. So I think that people need to temper their opinion of the sensational things they see on social media by understanding that that's not the norm. We have people out there that abuse children, that do terrible things to other human beings, and that's not the norm.
Yeah, good takeaway. And just the point that I found so fascinating is that, you know, they say, well, farmers are evil and they're greedy and they abuse their animals because they just want to make money. And it's actually the exact opposite. It's like, no. If you want to make money, you need the animals healthy. So they produce milk and so they reproduce and et cetera, et cetera. So really, really interesting stuff. Another counterintuitive point that I want to talk about a little bit is herbicides and then even pesticides more generally. You say that when herbicides started coming onto the market in the middle of last century, it was like manna from heaven for farmers. So tell us a little bit about that. Why are pesticides and herbicides specifically so important, and how do they boost sustainable farming compared to what most people think?
Well, again, number one loss after you put your seed in the ground, the number one loss that farmers deal with is loss of crop due to invasive weeds. A weed is any plant that's growing where you don't want it grown. So it's very hard to grow a crop profitably if it's being choked out by weeds. So when we were in, you know, call it the 40s and the 50s, tillage was prevalent. The dirty 30s were caused by excessive tillage of farmland. And it was because largely farmers were tilling the crap out of the soil, which degenerates the soil and degrades the soil, but they were doing it to control weeds. And today, when 2,4-D came along, when the era of chemistry began and we started to see atrazines and trifluralins and all the different chemistries that came on, that was a godsend. It changed agriculture. It allowed us to grow a crop of wheat without wild oats choking out the crop of wheat. It was an amazing time. And over time, what we've done is we've actually figured out how to use less and less and less chemistry. We've learned how to use less and less active ingredient per acre. Today, we farming in the 2000s use a fraction of the amount of active ingredient we did in the 70s to grow twice or three times the crop. And again, urban people wouldn't understand that, but that is the reality. And, you know, by some of the actions going on today, they're pushing us towards regressive agriculture, which means more tillage again. And, you know, when you compare conventional farmers that can use herbicides to control weeds versus organic farmers, for example, who just can't use herbicides to control weeds, they have to till. And so in the context of infinite sustainability, is it better to work the crap out of your land and degrade the soil and degrade the organic matter? Or is it better off to use a pop can of a herbicide over a football field? Like, what is better off for society, for the environment, for the world in general, if you start to look at this thing in context of soil health, water use efficiency, greenhouse gas balance? Those things are really interesting questions.
Yeah, excellent point. And you talk about this in the book, but you say that when a farmer is treating their crops with a pesticide, most of the spray is water. Can you explain that really briefly? You just alluded to it, but basically we're not drenching our crops in chemicals.
I mean, when you see these memes on social media that farmers are dousing their lands with chemicals, look at the back end of a sprayer or the airplane. People don't realize that that's water. It's anywhere between 5 and 20 gallons of water per acre. And typically we're carrying, the water is carrying a pop can of a product to be applied over a football field. So Roundup is applied at the rate of, say, a liter or less than a liter, an acre. So that's like less than a quart for a football field. And it's actually in that pop can, you're actually carrying 554 grams of active ingredient. And that 554 grams of active ingredient spread over a football field is has to be spread evenly. So we use water. So when you see a sprayer or an aerial applicator applying product, it's water. It's a water as a carrier. That's why you see the mist coming from behind the machine. Again, people would say, look at that, they're dosing their crops. Well, they're not. They're just using water as a carrier.
Yeah, very interesting. So next time you see a picture of some evil farmer somewhere trying to kill the environment with glyphosate, that's actually what's happening, is it's mostly water.
and just think about what you just said there, some evil farmer. Farmers go to work. It's one of the most risky and dangerous professions in North America is farming. And they put everything on the line. Fertilizer, they put their seed on the line. They throw down somewhere between $300 and $3,000 an acre, depending on the crop, into the ground to try to grow something so that you have the privilege of being a baseball player or a teacher or a doctor or a lawyer, so you don't have to grow your own food. And it's a noble profession. And yet in social media today, farmers are being vilified as evil. How would you like to be called an evil teacher? Or how would you like to be called an evil accountant or an evil architect or an evil baseball player or an evil lawyer? Well, maybe lawyers are evil. But how would you like to be, you know, how would you like to be vilified in social media, your profession being vilified by people who have no clue of actually what you do, other than they can beak off and call you an evil farmer? Is that fair?
Clearly not. And since you mentioned the whole, we're talking about pesticides and quote unquote evil farmers, another point you make is that chemicals are expensive. And so farmers, if they didn't have to use them, they wouldn't. But the reality is that the bugs will eat the crops before we can. And so they have to be protected. And so talk about that a little bit. They're not using very much and they're doing that because it's expensive. And you know, if ideally we would just have food, it would just appear, but that's not what happens. So talk about why farmers don't like pesticides.
Well, we don't like pesticides. We'll shift the conversation from herbicides over to insecticides. So insecticides are designed to control bugs and insects that damage your crop, like boll weevil in cotton or flea beetles in canola or grasshoppers in cereal grains. And so when those pests come in and start attacking and chewing up your crop, as a farmer, you have to protect the crop. So you would spray that crop with an insecticide to knock out those insects. And you do this whether you're a conventional or organic farmer, by the way. You do this regardless of the methodology of growing. You have to knock out those pests. And so we use specific products for controlling those pests, and the degree to which we can reduce the environmental impact or exposure of insects to those pesticides, the better. And so farmers don't have a real motivation to knock out bees or butterflies or anything like that, ladybugs. Those are all beneficial insects, but we still have to target the insects that are decimating a crop. And so over time, we've invented systemic seed treatments that allow us to treat the seed, and so that we don't have to spray indiscriminately, or we use integrated pest management strategies to determine thresholds so we can spray on at the right time and to control these things. Or we've utilized genetic engineering, which is absolutely a godsend again to us, because with genetic engineering, we can breed insect resistance into the crop so that the crop can resist the insects without us having to use any insecticide on the crop. And that is a story that nobody understands. When you throw out the three dreaded letters GMO, people freak out, but they don't understand that success story of genetic engineering, especially when it comes to insecticide, has been the net reduction of vast amounts of organophosphates and indiscriminate insecticide use on the crop.
Yeah, and that's a really important, and there's plenty of examples we can talk about. And one that you mentioned in the book is BT eggplant in Bangladesh. And I don't quote me on this, I'll have to check, but I believe it was something like a 90% reduction in the overall amount of insecticide they were spraying on their crops because of access to this crop called BT brinjal, which is an insect-resistant crop that you're just talking about. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, first of all, brinjal is eggplant, so most listeners have eaten eggplant. BT brinjal refers to something called Bacillus thuringiensis. And Bacillus thuringiensis is an organic, I'll repeat it again, it's an organic insecticide. So the protein, the CRY protein, C-R-Y proteins, kill, if you spray them on, organic farmers spray this on all the time, they spray on Bacillus thuringiensis, which is an organic bacterial, and it kills the worms, and it kills the Lepidoptera, which is a worm that goes into a brinjal. Now, brinjal is an eggplant, is a crop that you eat, and it gets attacked ferociously by insects. And so what they did is they took the organic Bacillus thuringiensis protein, the CRY, and they genetically engineered it into the eggplant or the brinjal. And so now farmers that seed genetically engineered BT brinjal, their wives, their children, and those farmers do not have to spray insecticides on the crop. That insecticide spray is so extensive that at times you're spraying brinjal 4 to 6 times a week. So you're going with a backpack sprayer, and you're exposing your human body to those insecticides at 4 to 6 times a week. And with BT brinjal, we can drop that rate 70 to 90% from where it's at today. So it's just a tremendous success story. And it actually is giving rise to some of the problems that are happening in India and Pakistan, because Pakistan, Bangladeshi farmers are using BT brinjal. India, because of policy, can't. And the farmers are smuggling in the crop because they want to use it because it's better for the environment and better for their family.
And good example, because the state governments, at least in India, are threatening the farmers with jail time. And a lot of these farmers groups are going, well, whatever, you can arrest us because we're going to plant this stuff because it's that important to our livelihoods. So, I mean, we're not talking about this thing that would be convenient if they had it. I mean, like you were saying at the beginning of the interview, it's not like food for them is like, well, I have to feed my family and I have to make a living. It's not, I'm going to drive down the street to Whole Foods and get myself some organic chicken, you know, or whatever the thing is. So we don't have to go over every period of agriculture, but you break up agriculture, I believe, into 5 different periods over history. But tell us about the one that we're heading into, which you call Agriculture 5.0. And we already started talking about it with bioengineering, but give us an overview of what's coming next.
Right. So in the book, I take you through 4 iterations of historic agriculture, kind of to present day, which is the era of muscle, the era of machine, the era of chemistry, the era of biotechnology. Now, we are entering into the fifth iteration, which is called convergence. And convergence is the convergence of technology on the farm in breakneck speed. And so what's happening is, Cameron, we're seeing a culmination of all sorts of technologies coming to bear on the farm at the same time. So auto steer, which is basically hands-free steering and swath guidance of tractors up and down fields, was at one time a technology you could install on a tractor by itself. But today, auto steer is also tied to data management, tied to GIS, tied to connectivity. It's tied to variable rate technology and precision agriculture, and it's tied to potentially to artificial intelligence and machine learning and robotics. And these things are all coming together, coupled with biotechnology and genomics and all this stuff is coming together. And it's a very exciting and time of rapid change at the agricultural level at the farm gate. And so that's why I devoted the second part of the book really to convergence and the convergence of technology on the farm.
All right. So, I mean, this is a big development then. I mean, we're not stuck in the same place. I mean, we have these big challenges, but we also have the tools, it sounds like, to tackle them as time goes on. The biggest thing, it sounds like, it's just the political and social objections to the technologies that can help us grow more food. Is that a good summary of things?
I think so. I mean, and so much of it really isn't so much objection. I mean, it is with genetic engineering because people simply don't understand it. And I say categorically, anybody who's against genetic engineering just purely doesn't understand the science of genetic engineering, because if you did, you couldn't be against it. It's that simple. It's a breeding technique. It's not an ingredient or anything else. It's just an advancement of the breeding technology. But with other things, like I'm CEO of a robotics company called Dot, named after the inventor's mother, Dorothy. So Dot is the world's largest agricultural robot, 175 horsepower, two Ford Cummins engine, that's capable of clipping to multiple farm pieces of implements to seed or to spray or to spread fertilizer or to haul grain. And Dot is an example of that convergence. And the struggle that we're having with Dot right now isn't so much one of people being resistant to it. It's the fact that the regulations are way behind the technology. And for example, we want Dot to be able to autonomously plant fields. We want to have two or three Dots in the field at the same time working to deal with the labor shortage in agriculture. And then we want Dot to move between fields on roadways. Well, there's no legislation for dealing with Dot on roadways. So we have to, again, get regulators thinking about the movement of autonomous or manless vehicles, farm vehicles. And this is vastly different and vastly safer than, for example, a driverless car like Waymo. We're dealing here with a robot that travels at 4 to 8 miles an hour and needs to move between fields autonomously, and yet there's no regulation that basically covers that off. So we've got to play catch up, or we've got to get the regulatory agencies catching up to technology so that the farmers can take advantage of what's going on out there.
All right. Well, tell people where they can get the book. It's out this week, so we want people to read it. I read it over a few days. I'm going to keep going back to it for a reference, but I think it's pivotal that people just learn a little bit more about agriculture and biotechnology and all these cool things you're talking about. So give us a little plug for the book.
I hope people pick up the book. I tried to make the book funny. It uses a lot of my own personal anecdotes, and I think there's a lot of aha moments, or people would say, I didn't know that, and I didn't know that, and I didn't know that. And the book flies in the face of a lot of the books on the shelf. So I would appreciate people supporting it. They can research it on Amazon. So they go to Amazon, they look Food 5.0, How We Feed the Future. And my name is Robert Saik, and the last name is spelled S-A-I-K. And I've got a website, robertsaik.com, robertsaik.com. They can go there and learn about my background and where I've come from and the projects I'm working on.
Excellent. Well, Robert, thank you for joining us. It's always great to talk to you, and we'll have to have you back sometime.
Thanks, Cameron. Thank you for taking the time to learn about the book and ask me questions about it. Appreciate it.
All right, everybody, thank you so much for listening. I want to remind you before we go to check out geneticliteracyproject.org. If you sign up for our newsletter, we will send you new articles and news updates, as well as these podcasts, right to your inbox. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.